Today is May 7th, Monday night at Sheret Israel. We're learning Parshat HaShavua. This week's Torah portion is Parshat Emor. And we are going to focus on two verses in the Parsha. As you can see on the sheets that I gave out, it's Sefer Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, chapter 22, verses 27 to 28. We're going to deal with these verses in a rather unique fashion, as you'll see. So here we are. I'm going to read the verses 27, 28 in chapter 22 of Leviticus. The Lord spoke to Moshe. Actually, I see that it's verse 26 also. The Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "When an ox or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall stay 7 days with its mother, and from the eighth day on, it shall be acceptable as an offering by fire to the Lord." That is to say, as a sacrifice in the temple. "However, no animal from the herd or from the flock shall be slaughtered on the same day with its young." So there's basically two different conditions here. One, that we don't slaughter an animal before 7 days, only the eighth day and henceforth. And the second, that you don't kill the mother and the young on the same day, no matter what age. So, ostensibly speaking, on the surface, it looks like, plausibly, this is a matter of compassion and mercy. You want to give, perhaps, the mother at least 7 days with the young, perhaps. And therefore, you don't slaughter it before then. And perhaps also with verse 28, you don't want the mother to see the sacrifice of its young. And many, many commentators talk about that this is to instill within us a sense of compassion and mercy. And if that's the case, then it connects to lots of other mitzvot that have to do with animals and with eating that seem to have the same theme. For example, anyone think of anything offhand?
Don't mix meat.
Yeah?
Mother's milk.
Right. Don't boil a calf in its mother's milk. Which is it's the same thing as has developed to the sense of not mixing meat and milk. And perhaps we talked in the past, I don't remember in this class, that there are those commentators that say to boil a kid in its mother's milk is the really the paradigm of cruelty. And that makes sense. Anything else?
Something about a bird.
Yeah, bird, the old bird.
And its eggs. Oh,
yeah, that one. Indeed so. Right. The mother bird, you're not supposed to take the eggs or the young in the nest unless you first send away the mother bird. That's in Deuteronomy, actually. It's listed on my sheet here. What you guys said about the milk and the meat, that's in the sheet here in A2A, Shemot chapter 23. And what we just said, what Charles just said about the bird and the young, is Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 4. Actually, that's 22. 25, verse 4, is the prohibition against muzzling an ox while it is on the threshing floor working for you. Which is perhaps a similar idea. We have compassion on him if he's doing all the work for our food. We don't want to prevent him from eating a little bit while he's working. We don't want him to starve for us to eat our meals. So these are just examples. We have there then two mitzvot in our verses today. Another three that I put in the sheet that we've mentioned. Altogether, five different mitzvot that in the context of animals and of eating seem to be teaching a lesson of compassion and mercy. However, with that, I want to go on to a Hasidic approach to this. And that's the Meir Shiloach, which we've mentioned a few times in the past. The Meir Shiloach is Rabbi Mordechai Liner. We're in Poland in 1816, 1860, 1870, 1880, approximately. And this is what's called a radical Polish Hasidut. So let's see what we can do with it. So on the sheets that I prepared, we have in the back of the first sheet a photocopy of an English translation of the Meir Shiloach. And if you want, you could look at the Hebrew. I'll just open it. I went over the English translation enough that I stressed it. Here. So we're reading as follows. It's the top of page 234 in this English translation. An ox or a ewe, do not slaughter it, and its young in the same day. That's the verse we just read in the book of Vayikra. The Targum of Yonatan ben Uziel renders this verse, and before I go on, I'll explain what is the Targum of Yonatan ben Uziel. Targum means translation, and we have in our tradition a number of translations of the Torah, in some cases the whole Tanakh, into Aramaic. And these translations go back approximately 2 millennia. These translations were done when less and less of the Jewish people understood Hebrew, and more of them spoke Aramaic. So the Torah was translated into Aramaic. And in some cases, the Aramaic translations, one of them, was actually read in the synagogue on Shabbat, verse by verse, together with the Hebrew. And there are some Yemenite synagogues in which they still do that. Read the Hebrew verse, and someone reads the Aramaic translation at the same time. You can imagine how long that takes. So some of these translations have gained an almost canonical status. Because you know every translation, to a greater or lesser degree, is also a interpretation. So at least two of these Aramaic translations, one is Targum Unculus, and the other is Targum Yonatan ben Uziel, have gained, like I said, a very, very exalted status in Jewish tradition as sources of ancient interpretations.
And this, are both of those translations into Aramaic?
Into Aramaic, right. The Targum of Unculus is actually printed in the standard copies of the Chumash, whereas the Targum ben Uziel is not printed in most of them, but it's certainly available. So the Mea Shiloach here brings the Targum of Yonatan ben Uziel, renders this verse, the verse that we're learning, as follows. Just as your father is merciful, so too shall you be merciful in the land. An ox or ewe, do not slaughter it and its young in the same day. So what's happening, of course, is that the Targum is not only giving you a bare-bones translation of the verse, it's also giving you an interpretation of the reason and the meaning of the verse. That it's in order to teach us mercy. And it's not just that God is giving a commandment that we act mercifully, it's a matter of what's called following God's footsteps, of acting like God, imitatio Deo, imitating God. Just as your father is merciful, so too shall you. So there's lots of different statements being made in this translation. Number one, that the mitzvah is about mercy. And number two, that it's about doing as God does. So I would say that there is an explanation of the practical mitzvah, and then there's also a theological statement. It's not just that God's commanding you to act merciful, it's also a theological statement that God is merciful, and therefore He is commanding you to be merciful. So it's not just a practical statement, it's also a theological statement, and why that's important, we'll get back to that. And then, the Mea Shiloach brings the Zohar. So I'll just take 1 minute to remind us what the Zohar is. The Zohar is the primary book of Jewish mysticism, the foundational book of Jewish mysticism. It's written in a combination of Aramaic and Hebrew. And the book presents itself as written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was a Tana, a rabbi living, he's a student of Rabbi Akiva. So we're talking about the first half of the second century. 1,800 years ago. That's the way the book presents itself, but according to most researchers, it's not that. And it was actually written in Spain at the very, very beginning of the 13th century. Very, very end of the 12th and the very, very beginning of the 13th century. That's the 12 teens. I didn't mean teens. The 12 single digits. 07, 08, 09 is when the book first became known in Spain.
But what year again did it become known in Spain?
I think it was 1208.
Oh, yeah.
1208. Now, the fact that the book might not have been written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who's the purported author, doesn't take away from the depth and the power of the book. It just means it's 1,000 years younger than what it purports to be. Okay, so he says, in explaining this same verse, the Holy Zohar writes, "We have learned that actions below arouse corresponding actions from above. If a man acts properly below, it arouses a similar power from above. If a man acts with kindness in the world, it arouses kindness from above, etc. It is also like this for the opposite. If a man acts with cruelty in the world, cruelty is aroused on that same day and strikes him. In the same way that a man deals with the world, so too is he dealt with." And this is really a very, very central principle of mysticism, that the upper world and the lower worlds are connected as if by strings. And every action in this world has an effect on the upper world. It's a matter, it's a way of affecting God. Now, what we learn from the Zohar is basically very similar to what we learn from the Targum, that the rabbis in the Zohar are claiming, when they're talking about this mitzvah of not slaughtering the young and its mother in the same day, it's talking about a matter of kindness and of staying away from cruelty, explaining to us the purpose and the meaning of the mitzvah, but it's also making a theological statement about God, that God will act accordingly if we act so. And then the author, the Meir Shiloach, our Hasidic author, says this explanation is in order to teach the children of Israel the attribute of kindness. Fine. And then he says, we find in the Gemara, that's the Talmud, in Tractate Megillah, that's the tractate that deals primarily with matters of Purim, but here has nothing to do with Purim, one was leading the prayer before Rava and said, I have to stop and explain the context. So we're in the Gemara now, we're in the Talmud, we're in Babylonia, we're in something like the 4th century of the Common Era. Right, the 4th century of the Common Era. And at this point, the Jewish people have a standardized Amidah, a standardized Shmona Esrei, in that it has 18 subjects, 18 blessings, but the content that was said for each of those blessings was fluid. It wasn't fixed. So the Shalich Tzibur, the prayer leader, the Chazan, he knew that he had to say these 18 themes, and he probably also knew what were the last few words that he said, Baruch Ata Hashem, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, for each of the 18 blessings. That was probably fixed. But the content that he said, this one or two or three or four sentences that he said before every word of blessing, Baruch Ata Hashem, Shomei Tefillah, Baruch Ata Hashem, Mekabetz Atamo Yisrael, that wasn't fixed. And he had to be a poet who on the spot, in an impromptu, he ad-libbed and he created the bracha every single time that he davened for the congregation. And the congregation didn't have sidurim, they listened to him and said amen. So you never really know exactly what the shliach tzibur, what the chazan was going to say. Again, you knew the 18 subjects, but you didn't know exactly the words he'd be using. So here we have a case in which it says, in the Talmud, in Masechet Megillah, one was leading the prayer before Rava. Rava was a great rabbi who was there in the congregation, and said, this Shliach Tzibur, this Chazan, this prayer leader said, you who were merciful with the bird's nest, and commanded that the mother be driven away before taking her eggs, be merciful with us. He added those words into one of the brachot. Perhaps it was the bracha about Shomei Tefillah, God, hear prayer. Perhaps it was, we don't know, perhaps it was the bracha of Modim, in which we give thanks. We don't know which bracha it was, but he used those words. And then it says, and he went on, he said, you are merciful in saying, do not slaughter it, and it's young in the same day, so too be merciful with us. He said a lot of words in his Shmona Esrei that everyone heard. Rava said, Rava, the rabbi who's in the congregation, said later to one of his students, this student, meaning that prayer leader, that chazan, really knows how to appease his teacher, meaning God. He prayed very well. It was really flowing. It was beautiful. He had some good lines there. He's a good poet. Abaye answered. Abaye is the student of Rava who heard his teacher praise the Chazan. Abaye answered, but we are taught that one who prays in this way should be silenced. Because Abaye remembered he'd been taught an explicit teaching, we still have it today, that says anyone who says those words that we just read is to be silenced. Silence means you basically say one more word or we're getting you out of here. You're not allowed to say that. So this prayer leader was in some sense a heretic. He said something you're not allowed to say.
So what he said that wasn't, what he thought was not allowed was to be merciful with us?
So what Abaye said is not allowed to be said are exactly these words that the prayer leader said. Now we'll talk in a minute about why that's heretical. It doesn't look so heretical, does it? Looks pretty fine to us. In the next sentence, Abaye, the student, quotes to its teacher the explanation of why those words are heretical. And unfortunately, the translator here of this English volume got it all wrong, so I wrote the translation, the proper translation, at the bottom of the page in pencil, which I hope came out on the sheets. It did. For he is interpreting God's commandments as imbued with mercy, whereas they are really decrees whose reasons cannot be known. In other words, what did the prayer leader said? He said that, I'm certain that the reason for this commandment of sending away the mother bird is to show mercy upon the mother so she doesn't witness her children being killed. And second of all, it's not just that God is commanding us mercy, it's that God is merciful. God is himself merciful and therefore he commands this. That's what that prayer leader was saying. And again, it sounds pretty good. And it's of course exactly what we learned in the Targum Yonatan just 10 minutes ago. But nevertheless, Abaye, the young student, quotes an authoritative source that says, you're not allowed to say this, these words about the mother's bird in the nest. You're not allowed to say this stuff about slaughtering it and its young in the same day, because you are attributing mercy to God, whereas in truth, these are decrees whose reasons cannot be known. So I want to explain this on a number of levels. What's happening here is simply a disagreement on the fundamental issue of rationalism in interpreting the Torah. And what I'm saying is actually pretty explicit in the Talmud itself. The Talmud says there are two different opinions. One opinion says that it's okay, and it might even be laudable, to use our minds to make the best effort to try to understand the reasons for the mitzvot. In Hebrew it's called ta'amei ha-mitzvot, reasons for the mitzvot. Because if you don't know the reason, how could you really fully devote yourself to the mitzvah? How could you achieve out of the mitzvah the purpose if you don't know the purpose? You have to try and figure it out. The Torah doesn't say, so you should use your mind to try and understand. But another approach in the Talmud says, no, forget it. It is a futile effort to try to understand the reasons for the mitzvot, and any effort to understand is really heretical, because who are you to claim that you can understand? All you can do is read what the Torah says and do what it says. These are two different approaches. And since the Talmud, these two different approaches have fought it out in the arena of Jewish philosophy, and there are many, 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 many books and articles and statements in this camp and in that camp. And there are many different types and of reasons, mystical and anthropological and sociological reasons for the mitzvot, and there are many who explain that it's absolutely impossible and heretical and futile to try to give mitzvot. Two different camps.
Is there a difference between studying and trying to understand the mitzvot versus studying and trying to understand the Torah? Because I thought there were large numbers of Jews in the world who dedicate their entire life to doing that, to arguing and understanding. So are we saying it's just a problem to do that about mitzvot, but not the Torah? Or are they the same?
Good point. The differentiation is as follows. This particular argument, disagreement of giving reasons or not has to do with understanding or trying to understand the purpose, the goal, the meaning of the commandments. What Jews have done for 2,000 years is trying to understand the mechanics of the mitzvah. What is commanded? What Jews study in the Talmud, what 70% of the Talmud is the what. What actually are we supposed to do? Whereas now we're saying the why. Why we do it, that's a big question. Are you supposed to ask why, or are you not supposed to ask why? And in the Talmud, this is absolutely and positively discussed, and the two issues, the two possibilities are on the table, and it's open, it's not decided in the Talmud. Yes, you can look for reasons, or no, you shouldn't. And throughout Jewish history, the argument is going on, and I'd say probably most of the thinkers agree that we are supposed to look for reasons, and Jewish philosophy is full of the efforts to find reasons for the mitzvot. But the Talmud and straightforward Jewish scholarship, what's done in all the Bate Midrash, all the study halls for 1,000 years, is not the why, but rather the what.
Gotcha.
What has to be done?
And see, I think that is so limiting to just only say, well, just do that. For instance, that Mother Bird, I saw a movie with an Orthodox rabbi. There was a bird that, first let me say that there was a bird that did make a nest in the windowsill of one of the yeshiva. A rabbi from the yeshiva said, came running down to this rabbi and said, oh, come quick, you know, do this mitzvah of chasing the mother bird away from the young. But that rabbi had no reason to chase the mother bird away. He didn't want the eggs. He didn't want the babies. What a waste. Just to say, I did this mitzvah, I don't see that.
Very good point. Wow, what was the name of the movie? Remember?
I don't recall.
Because that actually is discussed in the Zohar. ostensibly, the Torah says that if you want to take the eggs or the chicks, so you first send away the mother bird. But the Zohar understands that the mitzvah is independent of wanting the chicks or the eggs. It's just a mitzvah to send away the mother bird. And the Zohar understands it has mystical effects on the higher worlds. That's what that movie was based upon. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So sometimes you should do, even if you don't want the eggs, you should still scare away the mother.
According to the mystical understanding.
I remember reading about it somewhere. I didn't see anything.
I was so frustrated with that. I just wanted to go up there and slap.
Well, here's your answer. Just read in the Zohar.
Because it seemed just perfunctory.
Did the mitzvah. You're running up there to chase the bird away.
Right, so the question is, what is the mitzvah? Is the mitzvah to chase away the mother when you're taking the young, or is it just to chase away the mother? In any case. And certainly what you're saying seems to be the pshat of the Torah. Absolutely.
And some good is supposed to come from that.
According to the Zohar, some metaphysical good. Some metaphysical good. Yeah. So, on the one hand, then on the other hand. So on the one hand, as I said, I'm just going to sum up. In the Talmud, it's clear that we have two different positions here. Is it a good thing or a bad thing to look for reasons, look for the why of the mitzvot? And on the other hand, the Mei HaShiloach, the Hasidic author that we're learning, is not at this point willing to let it go at that. He's not willing to say there's a machloket, there's an argument there between two different positions. He rather wants to use what we've just read, the position in the Targum of Yonatan ben Uziel in the Zohar, of explaining this mitzvah of sending away the mother bird and this mitzvah of not slaughtering the mother and its young the same day. The Targum and the Zohar explains it as far as mercy, whereas we just saw Abaye in the Talmud reminding us that it's not mercy, it's just a divine decree, you do it without asking why. The Meir Shiloach wants to use these two positions, which we could just say are two different opposing positions, he wants to use them together to show they're not contradictory, in order to really use this as a jumping off point for a whole deeper discussion. And he's going to explain to us why they're not contradictory, these two opinions. Here we go. To truly understand the meaning of this law, of it and its young, that's this, not sacrificing them and the young on the same day, as translated by Yonatan ben Uziel and explained the Holy Zohar, we must understand that it's only in order to teach the children of Israel the way of kindness. What he's hinting there is, it's only about teaching human beings the way of kindness, but it's not to be taken as a theological statement saying anything about God. That's where he's going. He didn't say it yet. He's just beginning. The Holy Zohar calls all of the mitzvot advice, pieces of advice, meaning advice that teaches the children of Israel good behavior. In other words, the Torah is a book of advice for good living. It's about this world. It's about human beings. And it's not about God. We'll see in a minute what he's going to do with this. However, in the Gemara of Megillah, we find a man praying and saying, just as you were merciful, and we are told that he is to be silenced. I'm ending in the word because in prayer, we are forbidden from ascribing any attributes of man's limited understanding to the blessed God. This is because the function of prayer is to allow the blessed God to enlighten the eyes of man to a place that he otherwise could not have reached. Attributes of behavior are something that man has the power to apprehend.
Comprehend.
And I'm going to stop there. And I'm going to skip to the last three lines. Prayer is only to be directed. You see where I am? Only to be directed to his very essence, may it be blessed, which no mind can comprehend. I'm going to try and explain what he just said. This seeming contradiction that we have between, on the one hand, what it says in the Targum and the Zohar about the mitzvah being for mercy and kindness, on the other hand, what we have in the Talmud, that the mitzvah is only a decree of God and you can't understand it, says the Meir Shiloach, there's no contradiction between the two opinions. One is talking in the context of understanding the mitzvot, and there you're supposed to give reasons and search for reasons. And the other statement, the one in the Talmud, that said that the mitzvot are only decrees that you can't understand, that was specifically and exclusively in the context of prayer. And it was in the context of prayer. Right? It was someone who was saying the prayers for the congregation. So what's the difference? The difference is that Torah, he says, is for us. And of course, you can't get the most out of it unless you know why you're doing it. You have to understand, you have to try to understand. Why? Because the whole Torah is to be understood, according to the Meir Shiloach, from an anthropological perspective. It's for man. It's to help us live a better, more fulfilled, more satisfied life. It's to teach us proper midot of kindness, character traits of compassion, etc., 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 etc. So of course, when you do these mitzvot, you have to understand what they're trying to inculcate within you, of course. However, in prayer, he says, you should never have any explanation of the why of a mitzvah. Because prayer is about trying to access the infinite. It's about trying to access God. And in trying to access God, you cannot limit God by your human understandings. When you're doing the mitzvot, you have to use your human understanding. Otherwise, there's no purpose in the Torah, because the mitzvot are just about you. The mitzvot are not for God, they're for us. Claims the Meir Shiloach. So try to do them in the best possible fashion, which means understanding what they're supposed to do to you, how they're supposed to affect you, what their purpose is. But prayer is a completely different ballgame, he says. Prayer is not about this world. And it's not about you. And it's not about living a moral or a uplifting life. Prayer is about accessing something that's beyond. And in prayer, you cannot bring into this, you should not bring into it, your limited understanding of what God is and what God's purpose is and what God is about. Because then you're just closing yourself off from accessing an experience that should not be bound by your particular puny thoughts of what God is or what God wants of you. Present experience of the transcendent, he claims. And to me, that's pretty interesting.
Our prayers do. Our prayer books have things, though, that you talk about the attributes of God and such.
Yeah, you might say
we
that.
Like our prayer book at all.
You might say, indeed, what Caroline is saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, I really want to continue on this in this fashion that what you're bringing up. I think the Mishloach is really hinting at something very deep. Let me see how can I explain this. The Torah says a lot about God. Right? The Torah says that God created the world in 6 days. And in some cases, the Torah says that God is angry and God is merciful. In other places, God is cruel and God is vengeful. And it says God sits in heaven. It says God comes down and God comes up and God talks and God speaks. And it talks about the hands of God and the feet of God. The Torah describes emotions of God. The Torah is quite an anthropological, anthropomorphic book in some cases. And it could be that the Me'er Shiloh is telling us that we should focus our study of Torah on human beings and leave God out of it. Let me say it differently. It could be that the Me'er Shiloh is accessing here much earlier streams in Jewish thought that tell us the following. Look, the Torah is about human beings. It's about what God wants us to do for our own good. In telling us what we should do, the Torah makes a lot of statements about God. But perhaps those statements about God are not to be taken as truth statements, but they're just to be taken as efforts to cajole us and convince us to do the mitzvot. But they shouldn't be understood as having truth value. For example, the Torah says God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. What's the point of that? Perhaps the point is not to tell you anything about God. Perhaps the point is just to get you to rest once every 7 days. I'm not saying God didn't create the world in 6 days, I don't know. But perhaps that's not the point of the Torah's story of creation. Or the Torah says that God brings rain, the early rain and the latter rain, upon the fields if you do mitzvot, and if you don't, there's a drought. The Rambam hints that that doesn't really mean that God controls the rain. Rather, the Torah just says that because in those days everyone thought that the idols controlled the rain. And if God didn't say that he controlled the rain, then you'd still worship idols. And God wants you to worship him in order to free you from idol worship. So the Torah tells you that God brings the rain when you're good and doesn't bring it when you're bad. But perhaps you're not supposed to learn from that anything about God. The point is about you. It's about you. That the Torah wants you not to worship idols. It's about human behavior. And it could be, so many philosophers hint, and the Me'er Shiloh might be saying this explicitly, the Torah doesn't mean to tell you anything about God. The Torah means to tell you something about yourself and about this world and how to make it a better place and how to make you a better person. But it's not about God. And that could be the point of the Me'er Shiloh here. That as far as the mitzvot go, Yes, we want to understand the purpose of these mitzvot for mercy and compassion, teach you kindness. And when we're in the Beit Midrash, we discuss that. And we understand it. And we should discuss not just the mechanics of how to do it, but also the why. Yes, we should discuss the why. And in bringing the why, there might be those who say that God wants us to act compassionately because He is compassionate. But that perhaps is not a true statement about God. It's just a statement about what God wants us to think about Him so that we will be compassionate. So that when you get to tefillah and you get to prayer, don't let your image of God and your experience be limited by what the Torah says about God, because the Torah didn't say what it said about God to tell you anything about God, but simply in order to give a backdrop and background to how to do the mitzvot. So that we're separating completely here practical human behavior from theology and from mystical or metaphysical experience. And the Mishloach is saying, or at least it looks to me that he might be saying, don't let the Torah constrict and limit and circumscribe your spiritual experience. The spiritual experience of God is a very powerful experience that can be crippled by thoughts that you know something about God to begin with. So that the Torah can actually be crippling to the spiritual experience. Now think of this. Remember that the Torah says, no man can see me and live concerning God. And remember all the times we've talked about the imagery of transcendence, that God is beyond, and you can't see God, you can't know God. That's exactly what I'm talking about now. It's perhaps the true Jewish theology is only, to use the language of the Rambam, is only negative. That you can't know God, and you don't know God, and God is transcendent. And all the things the Torah says about God, they're really only anthropomorphisms. They're only speaking of God in human language to help you get a handle on God. Why do you want a handle on God? To understand the mitzvot. But God Himself? No, don't get bogged down in the Torah to understand God. Stop using the Torah to understand God. If you were to understand that God literally created the world in 6 days, and God said this and God said that and came into being, you're constricting, you're limiting your possible experience of God, and therefore losing out on a tremendous opportunity that human beings have to experience the transcendent. That could be what the Meir Shiloh is saying. And it's not so far out, because it really fits with a lot of things that the Rambam says and the Ralbag says and other Jewish philosophers say. Carol Ann.
How can you have a relationship with God if you don't know anything about Him? Relationships that we have with people.
Great.
Is when you get to know them, and you know their name, you know their nature.
Great. Great point.
Like and all.
Great point.
If you don't want to think of Him in some concrete relationship.
Can I just say something? I'm just going to say that my answer to that is twofold. One is, fantastic point, and for that we're going to see Rav Kook. And secondly, I'm going to say, but aren't there experiences and times in life in which it turns out that we denied ourselves the experience of getting to know someone as they really are, because we thought we already knew? We made certain assumptions, preconceived notions.
That's for sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Leslie?
I like the idea, though, that I don't know, you know, a specific thing about God, because it's bigger than me. If it were just, you know, something more concrete, I think it's more limiting, and it doesn't make it godly to me, in a sense. Whatever, and I mean, you know, within a bigger context, and I guess it goes back to, you know, because then it almost makes it, well, you know, you have all these people that are like false gods, or, you know, people think, you know, whether it be Jesus or something like that. That, to me, is not appealing. You know, I don't know why, but again, I don't think I, you know, really study enough hours in the days to be frustrated by not having, you know, a more concrete. I kind of like the abstract, and I'm pretty black and white on a lot of things. And in this one area, I find that refreshing rather than limiting.
Well, I'm smiling because you're saying things so similar to what we talked about in my class and why the Jews rejected Jesus.
Yeah.
You're right on there. It's very fascinating.
Oh, I wish, was my friend Brian there?
Yeah.
I can have a good run with him. He just ran he ran back-to-back marathons this weekend.
Goodness gracious, yeah, great balls of fire.
Yeah.
Back-to-back marathons?
Saturday and Sunday, one in North Carolina and one in Cincinnati.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
That's 50 miles.
I really wanted to go. I would love to have taken that
52.
Class. I just
could.
Right. 0.4. You really would.
Brenda?
Just regarding why the Jews rejected Jesus in that class and that point, the idea that we could at all experience something transcendent at all seems not to be a Jewish idea. Have any experience of God seems to be other.
Mm-hmm.
Away from.
Mm-hmm. I understand. There. Let me think a minute how I'm going to. So, yeah, very good points. So, a lot of Jewish study really completely ignores God and focuses only on the what you have to do and perhaps also the why you have to do it, but leaves God out of it. Certainly in a traditional Beit Midrash, you can go a whole day, you can study 10 hours without mentioning God's name once. Absolutely. And that certainly is part of what you're saying. With no emphasis, no study of theology, or of no experience of transcendence, and to use the words we used in the class on whether Jews rejected Jesus, that God is too far away to have any experience of Him. All you can have is the bridge towards God, which is the mitzvot. Now, what will often happen in classical Jewish life is, since there's no study of theology, no metaphysical experience, no transcendent experience, just the mitzvot, and since there is discussion of God in the Torah, in the anthropomorphic terms that are there, so what happens very often is that the concept of God becomes limited by the things the Torah says. And there's no metaphysical experience, but there's also at the same time a very, very, there's a limiting of the concept of God. Now comes here the Meir Shiloach and basically says, turn toward the metaphysical, turn toward the transcendent, and leave behind the shackles of your stunted God view that comes from misunderstanding of the Torah, comes from an understanding that what the Torah said about God was what was meant to be taken as a statement about God. No, it was meant to be taken as a statement about the mitzvot, says the Meir Shiloach. So the Meir Shiloach is certainly pushing us as Jews, and of course he's part of the Hasidic tradition in pushing us, he's pushing us to understand that the mitzvot are not all of Jewish life, and that understanding of God that's limited to the mitzvot can become infantile and become contracting. And he's telling us to search further and not be limited by the Torah in doing so. So
we have to look for a mystical experience according to him to have
It depends what you mean by mystical. But perhaps by definition, any opening oneself up to the being beyond is mystical.
Yeah. Right. Isn't it a little odd we're talking about a relationship with God? How can you have a relationship with,
yeah,
with something that's unknowable?
Right, that word relationship, and I really, really, perhaps you've heard me speak about this, I really don't like when American rabbis talk about having a relationship with God. I don't. It really sounds very anthropomorphic and very.
But isn't that because for a lot of people, maybe at least to initially be interested, they have to feel. I mean, it's easier if, you know, A to B, you know, there is a direct cause relationship. So for a lot of people, that's an easy way to kind of get hooked in or.
Yeah.
But that's why they don't visit Jesus.
Right.
Yeah.
You can have a relationship with Jesus. He's.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Well, is it more appropriate to say a connection that they're looking for? Let's say he's looking for.
That's better to me. Again, this is just me. I'm not trying to dictate to you, but I do feel like Charles does. I would call it an experience of the transcendent.
Okay.
Experience of that which is beyond. And what I'd like to do is read from the writings of Rav Kook right now. And it seems to me in many cases, although I can't prove it, that Rav Kook seems to be influenced by the Meshiloach to a certain degree. We're going to read from an essay called The Pangs of Cleansing, which could take us three classes just to read. So we're going to focus only a small part of it. I didn't bring the original of this essay. So let's try and keep this organized. Without a stapler, it might be a bit difficult. But here we go. The Pangs of Cleansing. It's page 261. It's hard to see the page numbers at the bottom of the page.
It's got 260 on the left.
It's 260 on the left, yeah. So we're going to begin in the third paragraph. On the left-hand side of the paragraph on the right, you can see I made a little bracket to say that's where we're beginning. The foundation of religious faith is rooted in the recognition of the greatness and perfection of the infinite. Whatever we conceive of is insignificant in comparison with what by right we should conceive of it. And what we conceive of it is not much more significant in comparison to what it really is. In other words, you can't know anything about God. Whatever we may say of the good of mercy, justice, might, beauty of life, and the beauty of life of religious faith or of the divine, what the soul in its authenticity aspires for is above all these. We cannot know and we cannot put into words the transcendent beauty that we aspire for, the transcendent divinity we aspire for. All the divine names, whether in Hebrew or in any other language, give us only a tiny and dull spark of the hidden light which the soul aspires when it utters the word God. In other words, we don't know what we mean when we say the word God. And God forbid that we should think that we know. Every definition of God brings about heresy. Every definition is spiritual idolatry. Even attributing to him intellect and will, even the term divine, the term God, suffers from the limits of definition. In other words, it's really heretical to say you believe in God. Because to call God, God, to give it a name, is to put it in a box, to identify it as a something. And that's already a terrible travesty. I always like to repeat what my colleague, Rabbi David Aaron, likes to say. He says, I don't believe in God. What I believe in, I call God.
That's a good one.
Right? It's a very good summary of what Rav Kook is saying. By the way, if you're interested, Rabbi David Aaron has 6 or 7 books in the market, Endless Light, lots of others, and they're really all, they're books without any footnotes or any sources, they're just beautiful books about Judaism. They're all distillations of Rav Kook. Without him saying it, Rabbi David Aaron.
Does he make it Rav Kook more understandable?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
It's worth reading.
He doesn't mention Rav Kook.
Yeah.
He just talks about life, but he does it on the basis of Rav Kook. So he says, I don't believe in God. What I believe in, I call God.
That's great.
Except for the keen awareness that all these words about God are but sparkling flashes of what cannot be defined, these too would engender heresy. Any word about God is heretical. Except if you know that it's just an effort to make a flash and to show lightning in the distance of what you can't really describe and certainly cannot grasp. Among people who have lost this basic awareness, they've indeed engendered gross heresy. So when Rav Kook says, among people who have lost this basic awareness, that the words aren't the thing itself, that the words don't describe what God is, why does he say among such people? Where does he know such people? He's only talking about the people he lives with. He's not talking about Norwegians or Canadians. He's talking about traditional Jews. And he's trying to tell us, to use the words of the Meshiloach, that we should stop using the words with which we understand Torah to engage in prayer. Prayer I'm using as a catchword for divine experience. Leave Torah out of it. Because Torah is about defining things. Torah is about giving reasons for things, about understanding purposes. And all that is very important for human life. But it doesn't work at all for the religious experience. And when you bring that stuff into the religious experience, as the Meshulach says, don't do, then you basically start engendering, according to Rav Kook and the Meshulach, gross heresy. If we become alienated from this basic perception that no words can describe God, then our faith will be impoverished and become valueless. There is no other alternative if our faith is to shine in a living light, but that it be linked to a level of enlightenment that transcends all particular values. The faith has to transcend any claim to understanding God, any particular understanding. Faith only should be faith that there is a beyond. Is a beyond that is completely wonderful. But what is it? Any effort to understand it makes it that much less wonderful. Makes it a little bit closer to things you can understand, which are exactly the opposite of what the beyond is. And this will assure stability to all values. All teachings beyond this perception of the greatness of the infinite, any other explanations, are only explanatory aids to reach the essence of religious faith. They're in the category of the limbs of the king and some in the category of the garments of the king, but they're not the king. And don't mistake them for the king. One who is disdainful of the garments of the king is also guilty of irreverence. In other words, don't make too much fun of those people who believe that the garments of the king are what it is. You can't make too much fun of them. But one must, however, draw a distinction between the essence of faith and the explanatory aids. Don't get them mixed up. As well as the different levels among the explanatory aids themselves. In other words, again, all the stuff in the Torah about God, they're explanatory aids, but don't mistake it for the real thing. The confusion of thought born of deficiencies in study and knowledge.
Don't mistake it for the real thing. We don't know what the real thing is.
Right. Right. Right.
So you can't mistake it for the real thing. But it just isn't the... You don't know if it's the real thing.
You're right. But Rav Kook is coming out against those who think they know the real thing.
I understand.
Yeah. So then we're on the same page. Page 262.
I'm not sure which page. I go stand on the top of the mountain. Inspired.
And leave the Torah at the bottom of the mountain.
Apparently.
The confusion of thought born of deficiencies in study and knowledge leads a person to focus his thought on the divine essence. And you should not focus on the divine essence because you can't. The more he'll immerse himself in the folly of this insolent and absurd preoccupation, thinking you can figure out what God is, the more he will think that he is thereby drawing closer to the exalted knowledge of God, to which he has heard that the world's leading spirits have always aspired.
So, when you hear religious Jews, and I'm not picking on any particular, I'm talking about people that, whether they're the modern Orthodox or Orthodox of some realm. You always hear people talk about getting closer to God. Is that, you know, is that something they shouldn't be saying? You know, by study, you get closer to God, or you're supposed to, you know, mimic God. But if we don't know, see, then that's a contradiction, because if God is, you know, just bigger than all of us, how do you...
We're so scared to say it.
I know, but you
always... Yeah, you're saying good stuff. You're saying good stuff.
Religious people that always say that you study, or you, you know, you're supposed to do the mitzvahs because it brings you closer to God. Now, you're saying you do the mitzvahs because it's to teach you to be a better person. You live in a world, there's rules, society, which is an important thing. And I mean, I once had a conversation when I first moved to Dallas with a Baptist person, and they couldn't believe, like, I don't go through a red light because, you know, they're going to go to hell. And I'm like, no, you live in a society, there's rules and regulations. And then, of course, I wasn't comfortable enough with my own knowledge to be able to refute some of those things. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, you're saying powerful stuff. That phrase, closer to God,
yeah,
it depends what it means.
Well, but, I mean, on, you know, the surface, you would think, unless it means just getting closer, you know, I don't know.
Let me use some language I used in the class on Jews and Jesus.
Oh, you mean I could be in that class?
So yeah, this is really, the themes are overlapping.
That kind of class.
I claim, basically, that Christians believe in getting closer to God. Jews believe in doing the mitzvot.
I'll buy that part.
But in a certain sense, Christianity is about religion.
Yeah.
Judaism is about morality.
Yeah.
Now, after having said that, you could go one step further and say, but since the Torah says that God wants us to do the mitzvot, therefore, by doing the mitzvot, you're getting closer to God. But what do I mean by that? I don't mean any type of fuzzy relationship, a fuzzy, warm, fuzzy relationship. I just mean that the only bridge to the transcendent is by doing the mitzvot that we're commanded. That's all we have. And since it's all we're commanded, that's all we have, you can define it as getting closer to God.
But it's not a good expression necessarily to use then.
Perhaps it's not a very good expression to use. And then comes these Hasidic authors, and they say, don't let the Torah lifestyle get in the way of experiencing transcendence. The Torah lifestyle is about this world. It's an absolute divine obligation to do the right thing. But if your only understanding of God is from the limited anthropomorphic statements the Torah makes, you're liable to be blinded from experiencing something else.
And that's where, when we talked about, even when we studied Rav Kook in that little class that we took, you know, I was right before I went to the Galapagos, and we were talking about, you know, you're supposed to live in this world, in the religious world, in the regular world, and, you know, one's not mutually exclusive, like Lubavitcher Rebbe, I mean, he went to the Sorbonne, or, so mm-hmm, you're mm-hmm not just isolating yourself from mm-hmm the religious. Mm-hmm.
And we've also talked about the Torah and its vote. We can't let them limit our thinking and our progress and our breadth of knowledge. We can't just stay so focused on, does it mean this? Is this allowed? Is that allowed? We've had that conversation.
Yep.
And in that course, also, you said that really that's a big difference in Judaism and Christianity, because the Christians want to bring down to earth with, like, in Jesus close to earth, and Jews plus God.
Okay. Yeah, I claim there that, of course, this is a simplification, but you're right, that Christianity has God always being accessible here, whereas Judaism basically says that God is not accessible. in any direct warm and fuzzy fashion, there's the possibility of the bridge to the mitzvot. You can call it, if you will, getting closer to God, but it's really about doing the right thing in this world. And now add to all that what our Hasidic authors are saying is that there's a whole world of transcendence out there, but paradoxically speaking, the Torah, if you misunderstand it, if you misunderstand the Torah as a theological document, which it's not, it's rather a document of rules and regulations, if you misunderstand it as if it's a theological document, that may get in the way of one experiencing God in a transcendent fashion.
I guess it takes faith to experience God.
It takes faith, certainly. The Meir Shiloach, though, is saying that, and Merv Cook is saying, that there are generations of non-Hasidic Jews, observant Jews of faith, but nevertheless, they close themselves off within the Torah from a whole nother experience. That's what they seem to be saying. So let's read a little bit more. Yeah. We are in the last paragraph in 262. When this habit pattern is established over many generations, various false notions are engendered, which lead to many tragic consequences. In other words, when people, by studying the Torah, think they're learning about the divine essence, then over many generations, this leads to many tragic consequences. And he's describing Eastern European Jewry as he sees it at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. They beget a state of confusion that undermines the individual's material and spiritual vitality. The greatest impediment to the human spirit on reaching maturity results from the fact that the conception of God is crystallized among people in a particular form, going back to childish habit and imagination. You learn the Chumash in second grade, and you learn there that God did this and God did that, and God has a form and God has a body and God, all that, and you get a crystallized picture of God in a particular form. And that, says Rav Kook, is an impediment to the human spirit. This is an aspect of the offense of making a graven image or likeness of God. This, of course, is an echo of the Meir Shiloach, against which we must always be aware, particularly in an epoch of greater intellectual enlightenment like our days today. So let's go on to page 264. In the middle of the page, I have that little bracket. It confuses everyone. In other words, these crystallized notions of God confuses everyone who believes in them, depresses his spirit, blunts his feelings, inhibits the assertion of his sensibilities, and uproots the divine glory in his soul. If such a person should repeat all day that this faith is the faith and unity of God, his statement would be empty, and it would register nothing in his soul. Every sensitive spirit must turn his mind away from this. And this is the atheism which is due to arise prior to the messianic liberation, when the knowledge of God is due to run dry in the household of Israel and in the entire world. What he means to say is that Rav Kook believes in his time that the footsteps of the Messiah are around us, and the Talmud talks about the Messianic era being fraught with conflict and war and heresy. And Rav Kook looks around him, and there's conflict and there's war, and there's great heresy. The Jews are leaving Torah and observance in droves. And Rav Kook, what can be, he says to himself, what can be the meaning, the connection between the coming of the Messiah on the one hand and all this conflict and heresy and leaving the Torah? What's the connection? How could the two be found at once? And Rav Kook's answer is that the heresy is good. The heresy is a part of a corrective to purify the world and the Jewish people. And to apply that to exactly what we're talking about, what he's saying right here, Rav Kook understands in his day, 100 years ago, that the conception of God among the Jewish people has become dry. and has become static and has become contracted. And that's part of what the Meir Shiloach said, because Jews are understanding God straight from the Torah, as if the book of rules and regulations for human beings was really about teaching you theology. And when you get theology from the Torah, you get a picture of God that's particular, that's as if you can understand it, as if you can put it in your back pocket. And that, says Rav Kook, will not provide true spiritual inspiration to any thinking person. So in our day, he says, when people are beginning to think and learn the enlightenment and people are becoming more advanced and the world is expanding its horizons, in those circumstances, such a limited understanding of God becomes an embarrassment, becomes a laughingstock, and people leave it behind, and people reject it, and people become atheists. And says Rav Kook, thank God for that atheism. It's a holy atheism, because it's a denying of a false understanding of God. And to say this the way my colleague Rabbi David Aaron says it, he says that he says to people, the God that you don't believe in, I don't believe in either. Right?
So, unless you're to say that the one thing we know about God is that God is one, it all erasing of all conceptions of God.
Absolutely. It is about, for Rav Kook, it's about experiencing that which is beyond the human experience. Which, of course, is a contradiction in terms.
Yes.
But to do so without the context of God.
Without the context.
Preconceived.
Right. Without
notion.
Without a word and its baggage. And after everything we're saying, it's just so easy to see how the Torah can actually get in the way of this spirituality that the Meir Shiloach and Rav Kook are talking about. And they're saying it's not that the Torah is bad, it's just you're misunderstanding the purpose and the place of the Torah. The Torah is about your life in this world.
What's prayer reaching spirituality?
So that's a good question. Right, because all this stuff that the Meir Shiloach and Rav Kook are saying sounds really good for prayer in the forest in a spiritual experience at midnight, but does it really work in the synagogue when you're in a very, very Jewish constricted framework in which you're saying specific words that have been scripted by the tradition? Very good question. Rabbi Nachman Mibraslav, who's certainly following this tradition, he basically says that Jews have to engage in a new type of prayer. And he says, okay, the halakha says pray three times a day in a certain formula, do that. But you should also search for the prayer that happens out in the forest, which is a cry towards the infinite. And without that, you're missing something of your religious experience, claims Rabbi Nachman Mibraslav. Certainly, Rav Kook is of the type who has a great need to search for his experiences outside of the synagogue and outside of the study hall, in the fields and in the mountains. But I'm not really answering your question, am I? I'm trying to wiggle out of it.
I have no idea. I'm so confused.
Are you confused or are you enchanted? Are you?
Actually, I have a different thought. You want me to share it now? While I was in Israel, I had the opportunity to meet Rabbi Lau. Rabbi Lau was the chief rabbi of Israel. He's now the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. No idea until I started reading his book. Rabbi Lau was 5 years old in Bougainville. And he survived.
Yeah.
At five. As we're talking tonight, I started to think, how did someone survive the Holocaust and end up as a rabbi? Because many people I've read or know that survived the Holocaust walked away because God wasn't there. Maybe Rabbi Lau is this person who separated God, the spiritual, from the Torah that deals with rules and regulations. Anyway, that's what I was thinking about, is because it's unbelievable. I didn't think a child could survive any concentration camp. It's amazing. I'm reading his book. It's funny the way things are. We had a meeting and he spoke. I really didn't know who he was. He was introduced as the chief rabbi. And then when we were in the airport coming back, I was just browsing around in the bookstore.
It's
all his book. And anyway, so that's what I was thinking.
It's all connected.
Well, not about Michael finding his book. But just, I guess so. I mean, he was 5 years old, and he was taken into Buchenwald. And he, anyway, I'm not really trying to get it. It's just that as you talked about this, how many times something terrible, tragedy happens. God is a mercy, right? We've heard that.
But maybe it's got nothing to do with God.
Well, I understand. That's what we're saying here, that there's a difference. Anyway, so that's what I was thinking about.
To lose faith over injustice doesn't even make sense.
Okay, that's getting a little bit another direction. That's the class we have Thursday mornings about why do bad things happen to good people. We're going to read a little bit more. It's a new paragraph at the bottom of 264, and then we're going to finish. The tendency of unrefined people to see the divine essence as embodied in the words and in the letters of the Torah is a source of embarrassment to humanity. Do you think God is that small? That God gets angry and God takes revenge? And God does this and that does that? And atheism arises as a pained outcry to liberate man from this narrow and alien pit. To raise him from the darkness of focusing on letters and expressions to the light of thought and feeling. Finally, to place his primary focus on the realm of morals, etc. Atheism is a temporary legitimacy. It's good at a certain point, for it is needed to purge away the aberrations that attach themselves to religious faith because of deficiency in perception and divine service. This is the sole function and existence, the existence of atheism, to remove the particular images from the speculations concerning him who is the essence of all life and the source of all thought. When this condition persists for a period of several generations of people limiting God in their conceptions, atheism necessarily presents itself as a specific cultural expression to uproot the remembrance of God and all its institutions, divine service. But to what uprooting did divine providence intend? In other words, according to Rav Kook, atheism is part of divine providence to uproot the dross that separates man from the truly divine light. And in the ruins wrought by atheism will the higher knowledge of God erect her temple. To cleanse the air of the arrogant and evil aberration of focusing thought on the divine essence, as if you know what God is. A preoccupation that leads to idolatry, a thoroughgoing atheism arises in itself no better than the form, but opposed to it in absolute terms. Out of the clash of these two opposites, people who think they know everything about God on the one hand, atheism on the other hand, will mankind be aided greatly to reach an enlightened knowledge of God, which will bring near its temporal and eternal happiness. So let's skip now to the end of the essay. We're going to skip to the last page. And I see that no page numbers came out in the photostat.
269 last page.
Yours did come out?
Yeah.
Okay, so here it did.
On the right side it did.
I'm seeing such convulsions. You see where we are?
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about, he means the convulsions of the Jewish people being, as it were, assaulted by waves of atheism from within its ranks. On seeing such convulsions, people believe that religion is dying, that the world is being overturned. In truth, however, the shadows are stirring. They're in flight in order to make room for the light. Right? That it actually could be that belief in God is darkness, because people believe in something that's just the shadow of the real thing. If religious faith is to be revitalized, a great effort is needed to deepen the knowledge of God. Now, knowledge of God, what does it mean? It means knowing that you don't know. To follow the most subtle paths of mystical thinking, Ralph Cook is advocating of adding mystical study into the curriculum of Judaism, through which one can rise above every kind of limitation in God. As it is a case of folly and weakness to ignore revealed knowledge, that is to say, Torah and mitzvot, the beauty and might exemplified in empirical existence, right, this worldly stuff, so it is foolish to detach our minds from the inclination to pursue the promptings hidden in the depths of the soul, without which one cannot discern anything sublime that transcends our dull senses, which have been dulled by much defilement and affliction. It is only thus, by mystical study, that the soul can be filled with knowledge and sensibility. It is only through such subtlety, help me with the word?
Subtlety.
Of thought, that the world will be filled with a light and the dew of revival, that the dormant will be awakened and the dead return to life. The best among the tzaddikim, the sages most informed the knowledge of God, must bestir themselves greatly to stimulate the interest in studying the greatness of God through all methods, the rationally ethical. Again, going beyond the limitations of the anthropomorphic statements of the Torah. Then will religion gain its strength, it will rise up out of its darkness toward the great light, will become the life-giving force to the highest and most sensitive of souls, even as it is in its authentic nature. Thus will it necessarily regain its respect among all sections of humanity. For the Jews, this is the anchor of the nation's rescue in this epoch, to restore to it the preciousness of religious faith in its purity, which is the entire basis of their existence. But it is precisely when the lights are in convulsion, difficult times like we have today, and the vessels that have housed them seem about to break. Looks like the Torah is going to disappear. It's about to break. It's being attacked from all sides. That there's a need to proclaim that indeed the letters, the words, and the facts, there's a mistranslation there, are not the essence of the light. But they are the vessels, the organs of a living body which bears within it a soul. Right? The mitzvot are not God. And the problem is, and now I'm going to say it in the clearest possible fashion, something I've refrained from saying for the past hour and a half, that people worship the Torah instead of worshiping God. That's ultimately the summary of what we've been learning. Now, there are good reasons to worship the Torah, and that's a good Lithuanian way of being a Jew. But the Hasidim have a different way. You don't worship the Torah, you worship God. And it's two different, completely different things. But let's read the last five lines. Raise up religion, elevate thought, acclaim the real life, lived according to the conceptual forms and the practical actions in which the imagination has robed the higher light. It is divine service through life, through the Torah, and through the commandments.
Did you okay. Just distinguish two different types of Jews?
Yes.
Sephardic?
No, I within the Ashkenazi world, Lithuanian, what's called the mitnagdim, those who oppose Hasidut, and then the Hasidic way. So the Hasidim accuse the mitnagdim of worshipping the Torah instead of worshipping God. And Rav Kook, speaking for the Hasidim, is telling us that we ought not to worship the Torah, we should keep the Torah, but we should worship God.
You said the Lithuanian are accused of worshipping
the Torah.
The Torah, instead of God.
That's true.